Jeremiah's lament. Today is July 25th. 3 days from now, on the 28th, 29th, the Jewish people, Jewish believers, are going to read the Book of Lamentations. They read it every year on what is in their calendar, the 9th of Av. Now, of course, you ask, well, why do they read that every year on the 9th of Av? Which generally corresponds around our July or early August period. The 9th of Av is commemorated amongst the Jewish people as the saddest day of their year. If you were to read the Jewish Mishnah, which is the collection of the rabbis' writings, they attribute 5 of the major catastrophes in the history of Israel on that day throughout history. In fact, say it's so fierce that they believe that day is cursed by God. Now, I don't have any insight into the future, but if Israel is the hotbed it is, and you know recently things have been going on there, perhaps it's the 9th of Av that we should look to. Let's look at some of those disasters that are recorded in the Mishnah. Now, the first disaster that the rabbis say was back when Israel was going through the desert, recorded in Numbers 13, 14. Remember, they wandered out of Egypt for 2 years, and the spies brought back a false report when they went into Canaan. Now, the rabbis said that was on the 8th of Av. It's not a thing we can prove that that's the exact day they came, but according to rabbinic tradition, that night, when it was found that those reports were false, God, remember, sentenced Israel to wander another 38 years in the desert because of that false report. And so God decreed, they say, that date to be a date of crying and misfortune. Well, there are other disasters that we can verify that certainly would tell us that's true. The second disaster that happened was the destruction of Solomon's temple. That began on what they would give that year as the 9th of Av. That first temple, remember, was built by Solomon, and the Babylonians came in, led by Nebuchadnezzar, in 586 BC, and they took the siege and sent Israel into Babylonian exile, where they have pretty much spent their time. Yes, they were regathered, but that was a real disaster for them that really, in essence, never was recovered from. Just as an aside, is when we think about the verification of history such as this, recently there was a published, Biblical Archaeology magazine published the top 10 biblical discoveries in archaeology. And one of them was the Jewish quarter in Jerusalem, where others say they never were. But there was discovered a 22-foot tower there, walls 12 feet thick, and that was where they really defended themselves against the Babylonian invasion. There, in the ashes and the soot, they found 5 arrowheads. 4 of those were bronze, and one was 4 of iron, 1 of bronze, right? So those 5 small artifacts, which would have been used by both the Babylonians and Israel, is testimony to the fact that that actually did happen. So we have a verification of that historical event found now in the archaeological digs of Israel. So the truth of Jeremiah's lament, which is read on the 9th of Av, every year the Book of Lamentations was substantiated in this archaeological discovery. The Book of Lamentations, which is read every year on the 9th of Av, begins with a single word, echa, which means dismay. It's ironic, because what is Lamentations? Even though they read it as in mourning, Lamentations, the book, was really meant to provide comfort to those who were reading it, and comfort to Jeremiah especially. in the book, there's not any mention of Babylon, who's ransacking them. There's not any mention of Nebuchadnezzar, who was leading that charge. Only person mentioned, or the only entity mentioned in there, is God. God as the one who's dealing with the sins of Israel. Though God brought misery on Israel and suffering to them, in this book we're told He has unrelenting compassion for them. He has great faithfulness. His mercy is tremendous. And that's the celebration of what's in here. The key point, and this is really the key point as we read the book of Lamentations that drives the purpose of talking about this with you today, is that God tells us here He loves what He is obliged to smite, and He's obliged to smite what He loves. It sounds like an oxymoron, but you'll see that that's true. What we have in the book of Lamentations with God, Israel, is an insight into how He deals with man in general, how He deals with the disobedience and fall of man. Jeremiah himself, in his main writing, the 29th chapter, verses 5 to 7 and 14, has that promise, remember. He says, I will bring you back to the place from where I sent you into exile. It's Jeremiah's book, his prophecy, that gives to Israel that knowledge that they're going to come back to their land. So it is with man. Isaiah, remember the prophet of 35th chapter of Isaiah, verse 10, the promise to man is given that even though he lost his position in Eden, he would return. Isaiah 35:10 reads, and the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. Much like the message we're going to find in the book of Lamentations given especially to Israel. God is going to show His compassion on them even though they're cut off. In Jeremiah, the 15th chapter, 5th verse, God laments over Israel with the words, for who shall have pity upon thee, O Jerusalem? Or who shall bemoan thee? Or who shall go aside to ask how thou doest? God is saying He's the only one that cares. No one else cares. Remember, Jesus also wept over Jerusalem in that last week of His ministry. He said in Matthew 23:37, how often I would have gathered thy children together as a hen gathereth her chickens under her wings. Would not. A tender, compassionate message that God is giving to the people of Israel, and Jesus reiterates in His own message. So it is with God's care for man. In the 8th Psalm, verses 4 to 5, we have a well-known quote. I'd like to read it from Rotherham's translation. It says, what is man that thou rememberest him? Or man's son that thou visitest him? Thou madest him less, some little, than messengers. With glory and honor thou crownest him, and didst appoint him over the works of thy hand. This is one of the things that's discussed in our very first studies in Volume 1 on the Divine Plan of the Ages. There, the pastor describes on page 175 his interpretation of this psalm. He said, David in this psalm refers to man in his original estate, prophetically intimates that God has not abandoned His original plan to have man in His own image and the King of earth, and that He will remember him, redeem him, and restore him to the same again. The apostle in Hebrews 2:7 calls attention to the same fact that God's original purpose hasn't been abandoned. Man, originally grand and perfect, the King of earth, is to be remembered. and visited and restored. He then adds, we see not this promised restitution yet, but we do see the first step God is taking towards its accomplishment. We see Jesus described and crowned with this glory and honor of perfect manhood, that he is a fitting ransom or substitute might by God's favor taste death for every man, and thus prepare the way for the restitution of man to all that was lost. Yes, Jesus, as the ransom, was a perfect man, an image of what God intended man to be. And as such, by viewing Jesus in that capacity, we get an insight into what perfect manhood would be in its loyalty, in its commitment, and also in its stature. So I'd like to share with you today the five chapters that are found in Lamentations. Now, most would say these are five poems. But these five chapters show, I think, five principles related to the permission of evil. And by looking at the lessons we have given to Israel in connection with their disobedience that resulted in their destruction and promised recovery, we see a picture of man in his disobedience and in his recovery and in his ultimate position before God. So these are the five that we'll look at. The first is that disobedience brings punishment. In Lamentations, the first chapter, verse 12, we read, Jerusalem says, you who pass by on the road don't seem to care. Come, look at me and see. Is there any pain like mine? Is there any pain like that he has caused me? The Lord has punished me on the day of his great anger. Of course, we have many who echoed that reasoning. Where is God? Is there anyone that can say why man suffers the way he does? For Israel, that unsurpassed beauty, that was Solomon's temple, is gone. Think of it. When you had all that grandeur, suddenly it's taken away. The command went over the land, and it was swept away, and they were taken into Babylon, into the nation surrounding. Likewise, Adam had the beauty of paradise, unsurpassed. We can only imagine what the Garden of Eden was like. But when Adam disobeyed, God said in that Genesis 3:17-19, when he disobeyed, he told him specifically that he would be excluded from that garden. The curse was put in place, and specifically, Adam was told that he would die. There's one specific part of that curse that I'd like to look at that I think fits well with this picture we have drawn for us in the book of Lamentations. In the middle of this, he says about the earth, that thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee. Remember, as Israel had that beauty of the temple and the glorious features that were there, Adam had this wonderful paradise that everywhere you looked was beauty. But now he says, thorns also and thistles shall it bring forth to thee. Brethren, even today, here we are, you know, over 6,000 years from there, and we have the earth is still largely uninhabitable. Oceans today cover about 71% of the earth's surface. If you exclude that, of that one-fourth of the world that remains, the 29%, let's call it roughly 25%, that's land mass, half of that, one-eighth of the total land mass is uninhabitable or unsuitable for agriculture. That's thorns and thistles. Man's home today is largely uninhabitable. One-eighth of the land mass is in use for cultivating and for living. The development of paradise, I think, is the future of man. That's part of the work that God has yet to complete. When we read in the new creation that things start to begin when resurrected man comes on the scene, and man's job is to develop this paradise. Isaiah 45:18 tells us, the Lord created the heavens, He formed the earth and made it, He hath established it, He created it not in vain, He formed it to be inhabited. I am the Lord, and there is none else. Brethren, the development of paradise. I think God is going to have man participate in that. Otherwise, there's no ownership. Today, we see the earth continuing to be desecrated. But man has eventually, God is going to promulgate in him to take ownership for that. Just as Israel depended on God and did not obey out of a loving heart, so we had with Adam, and so we have with man today. If we think about that, and you think about the resurrected billions, perhaps 20 billions that might be, there would be plenty of land to live and plenty of land to develop. This promise in Isaiah that the ransomed, those who have died of the Lord, shall return and come to Zion with joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. Not only would there be plenty of land to live and develop, but also the promise that God intended for Adam would come. Let's return to the picture in Volume 1, page 296. When mankind reaches perfection at the close of the millennial age, they will be admitted into membership in the kingdom of God and given the entire control of the earth as at first designed. Each man a sovereign, a king. This is clearly shown in the symbolic prophecy of John in Revelation 21:24-26. For in vision, he not only saw the people walk in the light of it, but he saw the kings enter it in glory. Yet none could enter who would defile it. None can become identified with that city, the kingdom, who has not first been thoroughly tested. None who would work or love to work deceit and unrighteousness. Only those whom the Lamb will write as worthy of life everlasting, to whom he will say, come, ye blessed of my Father, inherit the kingdom prepared for you. Man today isn't God's crowning achievement. Man today is removed from that. But we're told at the end of the millennial age, man will be a king. And man will want to develop that earth and inherit that kingdom. And each will be his own king. The second chapter of Jeremiah illustrates for us the second principle of the permission of evil. And this is a tougher one for most. But if we reflect on it, we can understand why it's important. God rejects what is his own creation in order to bring them back. In the second chapter, the second poem of Lamentations, we read, my eyes have no more tears. I am sick to my stomach. I feel empty inside because my people have been destroyed. Children and babies are fainting in the streets of the city. Certainly Jeremiah reflected on the great difficulties and trouble that were inflicting Israel because of their disobedience. Now what was so beautiful and glorious is taken away. Israel's priesthood led them astray. Their leadership let them down, caused the disbelief that finally put them in disarray. After God had told them in Amos 3:2, you only have I known of all the families of the earth. Now we quote that verse many times, but we forget the second part that fits with this principle. What's the second part of Amos 3:2? Therefore, I will punish you for all your iniquities. Brethren, God doesn't punish you because of what you've done. He punishes you because you're the one he knows. And he's trying to bring you along and teach you the lessons. That was what Israel had to learn. And that's really what we learn by the punishments and inflictions that we suffer. Israel suffered significantly because it wasn't keeping obedient to God and his laws and rules. So it was the third disaster that they had after the second temple was rebuilt. Remember, Nehemiah and others returned from Babylon. They built the temple. They built and Herod's temple went on, which was in Jesus' day. What happens in 70 AD? The Romans destroy that. That destruction began again on the 9th of Av. And the burning continued, we're told in history, throughout the 10th, according to the interpretation of the rabbis in the Talmud. So a third disaster that they commemorate on the 9th of Av also involved the taking away of the presence of God. That's the key principle which we see. Then the fourth disaster that we're told about is the Romans crushing a revolt some years later. Remember, as Bar Kokhba tries to defend the last parts of Jerusalem, the Romans crush that revolt. They kill over 100,000 Jews. That's recorded as July 8th, 132 AD, the 9th of Av. And the fifth disaster that's listed in the Mishnah, following that Bar Kokhba revolt, the Roman commander Turnus Rufus not only destroyed the temple, but he plowed the site. And if you've been there, if you've been to Jerusalem, you've seen it, the Iola Capitolina, that road that they put through there and renamed it. That site of the temple and the surrounding area was just plowed under. If you think of that glory that was there. That happened in 133, purportedly, again, on the 9th of Av. But there were more, just for information purposes, to show you why this day of mourning is so great. In 1290, King Edward I expelled all the Jews from England. That edict was issued on July 25th, the 9th of Av. They had to be out later that year. 1492, when Columbus sails the ocean blue, it wasn't a happy day for the Jews because they said on July 31st, the 9th of Av, unconverted Jews, those who didn't convert to Christianity, could no longer remain in Spain. King Ferdinand, Queen Isabella issued a decree that they had to leave. Prior to that, that was the largest Jewish settlement in Europe, the Sephardic community there. That wasn't the end of it either. When Germany declared war on Russia August 1st, 1914, it was the 9th of Av. That devastated Germany. It devastated Europe. I think the effects of that war continued until 1942. And again on July 23rd, 1942, the 9th of Av, the mass deportation began of Jews from the Warsaw Ghetto. Where did they go? Treblinka, the death camp, and the beginning of the Holocaust. Certainly another cursed day. One thing after another, disasters that plagued them. So likewise, brethren, man has suffered continuously because of Adam's disobedience. Every year, 55.3 million people die. One of every 13 people in the world. 520,000 are murdered. Not only that, the incurable, chronic, agonizing and debilitating disease that man lives with. Multiple sclerosis, osteoarthritis, Parkinson's, Alzheimer's, dementia, all those worldwide cover many, many millions. But you know, statistics really neglect the individual element of suffering. God is concerned with every individual. We can become cold and callous when we think of people in terms of statistics. Think about it when you hear the war. How many killed? But when you see the names of those individuals and you see a picture, it makes a difference. So, brethren, when you think of the suffering and you look at the statistics of death, think about the individual suffering that's going on. Let me give you a few examples. Things that you may not know about or haven't heard about. This is a person that suffers from Ondine's curse. You and I can take a breath And we breathe, we don't even think about it. People that have Ondine's curse have to voluntarily breathe. If they forget to breathe, they die. Many infants that have this just die when they fall asleep. Today, those like the person in this picture has to use a breathing machine continuously. Here's a person with fatal familial insomnia. I had some trouble sleeping the other night. But how would you like to be someone who can't sleep, period? A person who's normal until they're 40 or 50 years old, then this inherited disease shows up. They can't sleep no matter what intervention takes place. That can last for a year, and then the person dies. There's no treatment. The chance that parents will pass this on to their children is 50%. So imagine, when you're 20 years old and you see your parents get this disease, you know you have a 50-50 chance that in 10 to 15 years you're going to die. And how about this one? Progeria. A single tiny defect in the genetic code which causes rapid aging. A child born with this disease like this one is not yet 13. But on average they'll be dead by that age. It's extremely rare, only 48 people living in the whole world. Those are individuals, brethren. Those are the people, every one of those that God is concerned about. And when we think about the statistics and harden our hearts to what we see with individuals, remember, those are individual people that struggle every day. That's why you're giving your life to the Lord to help them. Revelation 21:4, a mighty promise that says God will wipe away all tears from there, every individual's eyes. No more death, sorrow, crying. No more pain. The former things are passed away. The famous quote, we heard it the other night from Volume 1, page 192, in the presentation Brother George had. The one highlight from there, talking about the kingdom, their sickness will be no more. Not an ache nor a pain, nor any evidence of decay. Not even the fear of such things. Can you imagine when one of these people with Ondine's curse wakes up and they take a breath? Or a person that gets their first good night's sleep in their 40 years. Beautiful picture. Number 3. Chapter 3 in Jeremiah and Lamentations illustrates the third principle. God's representative, Jeremiah, bears the deep grief of what was brought upon Jerusalem. In his Lamentations, the third chapter, the third poem, Jeremiah waits patiently. And he gives a command that the Lord is mine, he has hope in the Lord. I'll highlight just what is underlined here. He says at the end of this little dissertation, it is good to wait quietly for the Lord to save. Waiting for God. Waiting for God to accomplish His purpose is probably the greatest difficulty and challenge we have, but it's the challenge a man has to, and that's why waiting to see something done. Can you wonder why so many doubt? Can you wonder why our message of hope is so important? We've all had to wait. We've had to wait at airports. The Lord knows that. There's 37 scriptures that discuss waiting on the Lord. Just going to share a few of those. Romans 8:25. But if we hope for what we see not, then with patience we will wait for it. 2 Thessalonians 3:5. And the Lord direct your hearts into the love of God and into the patient waiting for Christ. Psalm 37:7. Be silent before the Lord and wait patiently for Him. And Isaiah 64:4. For since the beginning of the world, men have not heard nor perceived by the ear, neither hath the eye seen, O God, beside Thee, what He hath prepared for him that waiteth for Him. Paul echoes this in the New Testament. So are we grieved by the troubles of the world? Certainly. The challenge for us is to wait patiently, like Jeremiah did. God waits until it's the right time to act. not your time to act, my time. Israel waited 2,500 years after they were cursed, after they suffered this first destruction. Here we are 98 years from where we thought the end would be. Is it really that long? Jeremiah says in that lament, verse 3, 31 to 33, "The Lord will not cast off forever, but though he cause grief, yet will he have compassion according to the multitude of his mercies. He doth not afflict willingly, nor grieve the children of men." It's not God's pleasure to bring grief upon them. Jesus bore the suffering for man. Hebrews 5 and 8 says, "Though he were a son, yet learned he obedience." How did Jesus learn obedience? We're told in volume 6, says our Lord, page 120, says, "Our Lord, already fully obedient to the Father under favorable conditions, learned what it meant to be obedient under most adverse conditions." That's a lesson you and I are trying to do, but that's the lesson of the permission of evil. Jesus had to understand and empathize with fallen man. And though he remained immeasurably above it, he learned what it was like to have to obey under those circumstances. God does reverse the course of sin, but it's when his time is right. 1 Timothy 4:10 says, "We both labor and suffer reproach because we trust in the living God, who is the Savior of all men." That's an important promise. Jeremiah had to cling to the promise that he knew God gave him in his book. But yet in Lamentations, he cried over it. God's long suffering is because he needs to introduce a permanent change. A world that's sick, a world that's in trouble, today is being phased out as the lesson is being completed, but in God's own time. Number 4, Jeremiah's fourth lament tells us that the cup of God's wrath passes upon those who rejoiced in the evil of his people. In the 4th chapter, verses 9 to 11, he gives this lament: "Those who were killed in the war were better off than those killed by hunger. They starve in pain and die because there's no food from the field. With their own hands, kind women cooked their own children. The Lord turned loose all his anger, burning it down to the foundations." Of course, we would have this as an apt description of what Armageddon is for. It's to destroy all those systems of people who prohibited obedience. The world today hasn't made a lot of progress in solving the problems. You know, long-term problems never go away when you just put short-term solutions to them. And that's what we've done. Jesus said in Matthew 9:16, "No man putteth a piece of new cloth unto an old garment, for that which is put in to fill it taketh from the garment, and the rent is made worse." Back in 1970, the world's rich countries, remember, it was starting to be a fairly prosperous time, they all agreed to give just 0.7% of gross national income as international aid. Well, billions have been given each year, but there's 58% less than what was promised in 1970. Well, we've got all kinds of reasons for that. But it shows you, man, there's too many short-term problems that had to be dealt with. The long-term solution couldn't operate. And so today, we have problems with foreign aid even getting to individual recipients. It's not that we couldn't get the money there, but there's no way to get it to those poor people. That aid doesn't go to the people who need it most. Why? Because of corruption, because of these massive grand strategies that never work out. And the money simply is embezzled away by the leaders and those who are supposed to help. Even when we think about the military expenditures now in the world, we've increased them again, as you can imagine. Here we are back at the Cold War levels. We thought when the Cold War ended, you know, the world was going to become peaceful. We could spend our money on making it better. But recent data show us that we're back to $1.6 trillion annually. And you can see here on this chart, the expenditures are back up to where they were at the end of the Cold War. We look at Volume 4, 1916 forward. Brother Russell talked about the fact that the princes, the financial, the social, religious, political, people prefer peace at almost any price. And they'll do whatever they have to. They seek it at the ballot. They'll seek for the elimination of evil by voting things like this. And people are willing to give up rights for the public good. But that fear of the future that dominates will drive them to desperation. So Jeremiah says in Jeremiah 23:16, he says, "Don't hearken to the words of the prophets that prophesy unto you. They make you vain. They speak a vision of their own heart, not the mouth of the Lord." So any solutions we propose in the world today are short-term fixes, as we've done in the past, no long-term solutions to eradicate the ills and difficulties. The fifth lamentation, the fifth poem, indicates that God's favor was to be renewed in His own time. Verses 19 to 22 of that fifth chapter say, "You rule forever, Lord. You will be king from now on. Bring us back to you, Lord. Make our days as they were before. Are you so angry with us?" Weeping over destruction comes before a plea to help. So at the inauguration of the kingdom, Israel receives the kingdom in a position with tears. We have in Zechariah, that 12th chapter, saying that they would look upon God who they had pierced. They will mourn for Jesus as one mourns for his only son. Bitterness for the firstborn. And then the kingdom will be inaugurated with them. Israel was blind to its opportunity to enter the high calling in 70 A.D. And in 70 A.D., they were scattered around all four corners of the earth. For 2,000 years, it's looked like God abandoned them. But He never did. That was never God's plan. Romans 11:1, Paul says, "Hath God cast away His people? God forbid." Even though they were scattered, they maintained a separateness. There's no historical precedent we have for seeing the kind of return to the land that we've had. Amos told us that God would put them back in their land, plant them there, and they would never be plucked up again. So from Petah-Tikva's settlement in 1878, we see that He has continued to bring them back. God punished, not to be vindictive, but for a purpose of learning. He hasn't preserved Israel and the Jews for 3,500 years just to bring them to the land and then do nothing with them. No. He intends to bless them, and more so, He says, as Paul says in Romans 11, 26 to 28, He said, "This will be my covenant with them when I take away their sins." When the kingdom is fully established, all the people will come to Zion, come to Jerusalem with songs, with everlasting joy on their heads. It says, "They shall obtain joy and gladness. Sorrow and seeing shall flee away." When Israel receives its blessing, mankind comes and receives its also. So what are the lessons of Lamentations? The biggest lesson is waiting. Waiting for God to accomplish. It seems a long time. But when you look at the perspective of how long Israel waited, our waiting at this end of the age is not that long. Jeremiah had a lot of patience. He saw that God was dealing with Israel to teach them a lesson of obedience. For us, brethren, faith requires patience. We know that God has promised mercies to everyone. But we also see, just as with Israel, the misery, the pain had to come first. And that just as Jeremiah did, we need to maintain that deep trust despite all the trouble that's around us. We must be like Jeremiah. Wait and never give up. God waited until it was the right time to act. Israel never wanted to wait for God's blessings. They wanted a king after judges. They wanted a king. They wanted other things. Man has always looked for a quick fix as well to everything. But silence and waiting is very unappealing. We're in a world of immediate gratification. When you hear that text come in on your phone, I bet you grab it in an instant. That's immediate gratification. That's the way we're being trained. Brethren, we can't look at it that way when we look at God's plan. Silence and waiting, even though unappealing, is important. Prayer is oftentimes an exercise in patience. We must wait for that conclusion. God will act in His time, the very best time. The permission of evil is not forever. Romans 8:21-23 tells us the creation groans. And the creation will be set free from its slavery to corruption into the freedom of the glory of the children of God. We know the whole creation groans and suffers the pains of childbirth together until now. Not only this, but we ourselves, having the first fruits of the Spirit, even we ourselves groan within ourselves, waiting eagerly. You can wait eagerly, but you must wait for our adoption as sons, the redemption of our body. Brethren, great is the road we climb, but the crown that's offered by an easier effort is not worth the gathering. Amen.